the English abroad do not have a very good reputation. Not only do we habitually embarrass ourselves when we travel, we then complain about the places that we've traveled through. Listen to these real complaints that travel agents have received from their British customers. On my holiday to Goa in India, I was disgusted to find that almost every restaurant served curry. I don't like spicy food at all. It's lazy of the local shopkeepers to close in the afternoons. I often need to buy things during siesta time. This should be banned. We booked an excursion to a water park, but nobody told us that we needed to bring our swimming costumes. The beach was too sandy. No one told us there would be fish in the sea. The children were startled. There was no egg slicer in the apartment. Complaints, complaints, moan and moan. I wonder, though, as Christians traveling with God on our way to heaven, we too have our fair share of complaints, don't we? How often do we find ourselves thinking that the journey is harder than we expected, that the view is not as good, that we don't like the other travellers, that we keep on not getting, we just don't quite get what we expected to get, or quite enough of what we think we need to keep us going. Perhaps we even wonder whether we might be better off never having started this journey at all. Well, if so, at least we're not alone. In the Israelites' great journey on the way to the Promised Land, grumbling was their most besetting sin. Just bear with me a moment. And here they are at it again. In the desert, the whole community grumbled with Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire community assembly to death." Now, to us, a complaint like that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Amusing. I mean, did Pharaoh really supply unlimited beef stew? I think not. And were they actually starving at this point? Well, actually, no. They had their flocks with them. They had milk and meat, at least. But the sands of the desert played tricks on their memory of their past and their imagination of the future. They did not remember what the Lord had already done, what they had been saved from, and they failed to believe in what he could do and grasp what he had saved them for. They clearly did not realize how laughable their complaints actually sound. And so, instead of appealing to God, which is a perfectly acceptable and necessary thing for a faithful person to do, we find them complaining against God. Well, actually, they complained against the travel agents, didn't they? Moses and Aaron. But in so doing, they were complaining against their tour provider, the Lord himself, as Moses makes clear in verse 8. "Who are we? You're not grumbling against us, but against the Lord." Here is a lesson which we need to learn, one which I confess I myself need to learn, even about the most minor of things. We must remember that any complaint we have about our experiences or circumstances as a believer is ultimately a complaint against God. For he is the one who rules over our experiences and our circumstances. We are complaining about how he has treated us, how he has led us, how he has provided for us. We must let that temper our attitude. Are we bringing a complaint against him? Well, if so, we need to beware. God is very patient with the Israelites here. But then they're very early on in their journey, aren't they? He may not be so patient with us. If, on the other hand, we bring our needs to him, what will we find? The answer is we will find a God who knows and supplies our needs. That the God we meet in this long chapter the Lord our provider. We'll find first of all about what he provides, then how we can receive it. But notice, like last week, God's provision is also a test. Will they trust him? And will they obey him? The Lord said to Moses, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. So in this passage, the Lord meets the Israelites' perceived need for food. First of all, there comes a one-off, which we find in verse 13. Then that evening, quail came and covered the camp. Now, this was a miracle of timing and extent. Small birds, like a quail, do still migrate in flocks across the desert and flop, exhausted and easy to catch, back into the sand. The remarkable thing was the quantity and timing of it. But that was a one-off. As far as we know, it only happened on one other occasion. After that comes the regular provision. In the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thick flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. This is the manna. The word manna literally means, what is it? That's where the name comes from. And we still don't know what it was. Scholars come up with weird explanations involving excretions from insects, which I find thoroughly inconvincing and don't help me believe at all. Far rather, I think, to simply say that it was a miraculous provision from God. And it was given not only to feed them, but to train them and test them. The promise was that he would give them each morning what they needed for that day and that day alone, except for Sabbath itself. That's no use then storing up for the future, as some tried. They attempted to store it up, verse 20. Some of them paid no notice to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and it began to smell, and Moses was angry at them. They would have to get used to trusting God day by day by day and obeying him. Apart from the Sabbath, he would give them today's food today and tomorrow's food tomorrow. The same principle applies to our material needs today. Remember the Lord's Prayer we've just prayed. Give us each day our daily bread. Now, of course, in our situation, we may be in a position where it is wise and right to store up resources for the future, to provide for ourselves. Remember, the Israelites didn't have to live like this for the whole of their history. But we must not imagine that that's what will bring us contentment. Nor must we think that that is the way in which our needs are fundamentally met by our own provision. If you look to your grain barn or to a pension fund to give you peace of mind, you will never have quite enough. Our attitude should be to expect God to give us what we need today to do whatever he has called us to do today. He is not unreasonable, you know. You see, if you think about it, to ask us to believe for one day's provision is actually considerably easier than for us to believe for a whole lifetime's provision. That's quite a lot, isn't it? To believe that God will provide for the rest of your life. Try believing that he'll provide for one day, today. That's rather easier. And of course, you only actually ever need one day's worth of anything at all. But there's a deeper meaning, of course. The Lord provides for our spiritual needs. They recognized this even in Old Testament times. So Moses later reflected on these events in the book of Deuteronomy. Chapter 8, verse 3 says, "He humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." The point was, they were to look to him for their spiritual sustenance, not just for their breakfast. And you probably know, a starving Christ himself quoted these words to Satan when tempted to provide bread for himself rather than rely upon God the Father. But he later goes on to say something even more remarkable. After he has fed thousands of people with one packed lunch. We find this in John chapter 6, and we should all look this up because it's important. So John chapter 6, which you'll find the verses we're looking at on pages 1070. As Jesus addresses the queries of various slightly sceptical listeners, verse 31, in fact, says, this is the query they put to him, "Our forefathers ate the manna in the desert, as is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth, it's not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Sir, they said, from now on give us this bread. Then Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty." So, do we get that? He says, I am the bread of life. I am God's provision for your ultimate spiritual needs. If you want to live a day, eat manna or Weetabix or whatever else God has provided for that purpose. But if you want to live forever, eat me. Verse 47. I tell you the truth. He who believes has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your forefathers ate the manna in the desert, yet they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. The bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Now, in this context, by eat, he clearly actually means believe. Verse 47 makes that clear. I tell you the truth, he believes in me has everlasting life. It's a metaphor for believing. But what he's saying is that if you do that, you will receive eternal spiritual sustenance. You'll get true soul food. You'll get the provisions that your heart craves. God brings us through the trials and hardships of our spiritual journey to test out whether we will truly trust in and follow Jesus. And if we do, he will use those times to prove that he can be trusted. He will be there for us. Not perhaps giving us everything that we want, but supplying what we need for one more day of your walk with Christ. Now, will you believe that? Can you believe that? That through the Lord Jesus Christ, God can and will sustain you through this life, through each and every one of its trials. It's hard to believe, isn't it? Because unless you have a particularly bad imagination, there are surely all kinds of situations where you think your spirit would wither and die, starved and parched in the desert. Yet he can be trusted. And that's the evidence I receive from the people who I deal with as a pastor. Our sister Jackie Payton went to be with the Lord this week. Those of you who don't know her, she was a former member of our church. Her husband went to be the pastor of a church in Ipswich a year or two ago. Now, she's died of cancer. Now, at a human level, there is no purpose to this horrible business. I mean, those of you who know her, just think what she went through in her life. She had cancer 3 times, first one at 21. Each one involving grueling treatments and debilitating operations, and eventually proving ineffective. She's been through the death of a beloved son at the age of 7, not to mention many minor trials in life with work and finances and so many other things. And then she had to face leaving behind her 2 children and a husband who still very much love her, still very much need her. But you have to say, in human terms, where is the sense in that? Why bother keep going if that's what God has done to you? In fact, it's almost offensive to try and suggest that there is any sense to it. Yet, Even last Monday, she said, I still don't really know what my gifts have been. I thought about that, and the next day I felt prompted to write back and say, Jackie, your gifts have been faith and encouragement. You have been through so much, you have kept the faith. You have persevered, following Christ, through so much when others would have fainted. You have at times brought your complaints and requests to God, but you've never brought them against him. What you've done is give God the chance to prove himself faithful, to prove that he can sustain someone through awful circumstances until they reach their journey's end. And so, Jackie, you've encouraged us to believe and to trust that we too can make that trip, whatever it might look like for us. That's what you've showed us, Jackie. The Lord provides. Whatever we go through, however we feel, he is there and gives us what we need, not for a whole life, but for one more day, one more step on that road. Will you believe that? Will you trust that? Well, if so, let's go to the second part. The Lord provides. If you believe it, how can you receive it? Will you obey? Will you accept God's provision in his terms? What do you actually have to do to gain and sustain faith that sees you through? Well, being a Christian, following Christ, is fundamentally down to faith, to believing. It's a spiritual thing. But God knows full well that we are physical beings, and faith needs tangible focus and expression to be sustained. So he has given us particular things to do. We call them the means of grace, by which our faith can be focused and exercised and expressed and strengthened, and also by which our obedience can be tested. We might list things like reading scriptures, prayer, attending church, being baptized, but there are two that emerge prominently from this passage. The first one, briefly, is the Lord's Supper, which we sometimes call communion. We read that Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread and broke it, saying, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." There's no need to imagine magic going on, as if these words mean that the bread is literally transformed into Jesus' flesh, except it doesn't look like it. The point is, it stands for what Christ did for us on the cross, dying for our sins. So our physical eating, taking bread into our body, makes tangible our spiritual believing, taking his spiritual sustenance into our hearts. God gave us communion as a means to sustain our faith, knowing how prone we are to forgetting and disbelieving, especially things that we can't see or touch. And we need it. So if you as a Christian regularly miss it, don't be surprised if your faith starts to feel weak and feeble. And if you feel as a person it doesn't do much for you, well, don't be deceived. You do still need it. And in the end, remember, it is a command. Do this in remembrance of me. A test to see whether we really are still trusting in the Lord. Sharing in communion, well, it's a test to see whether we're humble enough to show that we depend upon his provision all the time, or do we imagine that we've outgrown the need for things like that? But the second thing, and I'm spending a little more time on this, is the Sabbath, which emerged quite strongly in this passage, isn't it? Now, we're familiar with the idea in Genesis that God took a day of rest from his creating work. And we're also familiar with the Sabbath from the commandments, where he instructed his people to follow and copy him. But the fourth commandment wasn't in fact new to the people of Israel. They'd already been instructed to keep one day special and work free, in particular by not going out manna hunting. Since God has planned to take that day off anyway and not make any manna, there was no point them doing it. But more to the point, it was also a test, the Sabbath day, In this day I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day they are to prepare what they bring in, and that's to be twice as much as the other, as they gather on other days. It was to be a test. Now, there are definitely changes in the way we understand and apply the Sabbath principle into New Testament times. It's not to be hedged around by all kinds of petty regulations, as the Jews in Jesus' day did. It's not to be enforced by punishments and executions, as it was at times. Of course, we now celebrate the first day, looking forward to the rest of heaven, rather than the seventh day, looking back to the work of creation and slavery in Egypt. And how quite one applies it, what it entails, whether personal conscience plays an important role in that. The Bible says we shouldn't judge each other by how we keep a spiritual, a holy festival of one kind. So how one puts it into practice in the modern world does require a degree of creativity. It certainly requires planning. It doesn't look the same. It doesn't even happen on the same day for every single person. To list the reasons for that would be tedious, because I think they're rather obvious. So having said all of those things, it's still the case, though, that the principle still applies. The Lord still calls us to keep one day in seven special, free from doing things that don't need to be done, free from a daily routine, where possible, of work or employment, free from household chores, perhaps, homework and cutting the grass, free from things that burden us or distract us, free to enjoy life, free to enjoy creation, free to enjoy our relationships and family and friends, free to enjoy our possessions, free to enjoy his peace and his rest, most of all, free to enjoy him. We must remember that's not a burden, that's a privilege. It's a blessing to enrich us and bless us and sustain us. Remember, Pharaoh didn't give his slaves any days off at all. The Lord our provider commanded them to take one off. So how bizarre then that some of the Israelites still insisted on going to work that day. Verse 27, nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. But then we take a lot of persuading about God's wisdom, don't we? We've been seduced by the idolatry of work. So we often genuinely believe that many of the things we do are so important the sky will fall in if we don't do them. We struggle to really believe that God's way is right and wise. Our work will be more profitable, our studies will be more fruitful, our families will be more harmonious if we do things God's way. If sometimes we cut back the doing and enjoy some being. But alas, in this matter, we choose to be conformed by the world so often to our own detriment. It's not easy in our busy world. I know that. And in all kinds of circumstances, we have to be creative. In my own life, for example, I work quite hard on the average Sunday and need to find times when I rest at other times. Other things are complicated, aren't they? The pattern of working life and activities. But the point is, when you seek to honour the Lord, however best you can, it works. My own testimony was at university. I did one of the busiest degrees in England. I think I had 27 hours of set lectures and tutorials every week, and lectures every Saturday morning from 9 till 12 at least, sometimes 1. Now, I remember sitting down on my first Sunday at uni with some maths problems to do, like everyone else seemed to be doing, except I just couldn't do them. 4 hours later, I decided I was wasting my time and God's too, and decided never to do them again on a Sunday. So even with an essay due on a Monday or in the middle of my finals, I gritted my teeth and resisted the urge to work. The result was that the Lord gave me a whole extra day a week. I got everything done in 6 days, just as well, and then had a seventh to enjoy. Could go to church twice and actually learn something. Could call my mum, write letters. I could do sport if it didn't conflict with church. I had a laugh at hungover friends as they struggled with their essays. I also quit maths, which was quite important. And And in the end, I found that my degree was certainly no worse than it would have been. And my life was a whole lot better. Try it and see, even only in small ways, within the limits of what your life permits. Where you must work on a Sunday, reclaim it elsewhere. God has given you this day as a means for him to bless you and sustain you. Remember that these days you are more likely to be worked to death than starved to death, won't you? But if in the end the benefits don't persuade you, do remember that in the end it's also a means by which he tests us. Find out what is in our hearts. In the end, what do our hearts say about God? Will you rely on what he says or trust your own opinion? Will you go for what he offers in life, or is your heart really set on the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week slavery of Egypt and its mythical pots of meat? Do you really want to follow Jesus or not? So in this matter, how you lose the Lord's day, do not allow yourself to be judged by anyone else, but do you allow yourself to be tested by the Lord. And don't, whatever you do, complain in your heart about God's command to rest for a day. Remember those silly tourists? It took us 9 hours to fly home from Jamaica to England. It only took the Americans 3 hours to get home. That's not fair. The brochure stated, no hairdressers at the accommodation. We're trainee hairdressers, so can we come? There are too many Spanish people. The receptionist speaks Spanish. The food is Spanish. Too many foreigners now live abroad. I was bitten by a mosquito. No one said they could bite. My fiancé and I booked a twin-bedded room, but we were placed in a double-bedded room. We now hold you responsible for the fact that I find myself pregnant. This would not have happened if you'd put us in the room we'd booked. Stupid, aren't they? Those tourist questions, those tourist complaints. So how stupid is this one? I am not happy. I am outraged and burdened by the fact that you have given me a day off and require me to take it. How ridiculous that we should find that a burden and a problem when it's such a good thing. Aren't we daft? If you trust and obey, turn to the Lord rather than against him, then he will provide and give you each day your daily bread until you rest with him. He did that for the Israelites. The Israelites ate manna for 40 years until they came to the land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. And he will do that for you.